ॐ सहना भवतु सहनो भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा द्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. May the Supreme Lord protect both the teacher and the student, and may He cherish and nourish us both. May we work with full energy, may our study be perfect, and may it give us good results. May we never feel ill will towards others. So today we're studying chapter 12, which is entitled Devotional Service. Of course, the emphasis throughout these middle six chapters is devotional service, but here we're coming to a culmination where, by Arjuna's mercy, by the mercy of his questions, we're getting a very, very clear and solid understanding of the supremacy of bhakti, and in particular Ananya bhakti. And so it will very much strengthen our conviction by studying this chapter. Also, we notice in the verses 13 to 20 that many, many qualifications or qualities of the Ananya bhakti are given. So we also get some guideline. Krishna is giving us the formula for how to attain him in 11:55. And then in the 12th chapter, he's giving the qualities that would be very nice if we developed as devotees, so that the proper bhav, or the proper mood, is also there with the behavior for attaining him. So I'd like to begin chapter 12 by sharing with you two Bhaktivedanta purports on the significance of this chapter. Perhaps Parvati, if you can come out and read them. The first one is from the first purport of chapter 12, and the second quote is from the 20th purport of chapter 12.
Chapter 12, main points, highlights. We find in this chapter that of the different processes for realization of the absolute truth, bhakti yoga, devotional service, is the highest. If one at all desires to have the association of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then he must take to devotional service. There are ways to realize the absolute truth, but Krishna indicates in this chapter that bhakti yoga, or devotional service to him, is the highest of all. It is the most direct, is the easiest means for association with Godhead. That's verse 12:1 purport. In this chapter, it is decided that through good association, one develops attachment for pure devotional service and thereby accepts a bona fide spiritual master, and from him begins to hear and chant and observe the regulative principles of devotional service with faith, attachment, and devotion, and thus becomes engaged in the transcendental service of the Lord. Boy, that's a long sentence. This path is recommended in this chapter. Therefore, there is no doubt that devotional service is the only absolute path for self-realization, for the attainment of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's verse 12:20 purport.
Prabhupada about the glories of the 12th chapter and of Ananya Bhakti, and how he's repeatedly saying it's the best, it's the best, it's the best. The intelligent person will ask, well, why is it the best? Isn't it? We don't want to hear somebody just tell us it's the best. We want to understand why it's the best. So Prabhupada gives an amazing statement in his introduction to this Gita on page 23. It begins straight after him quoting 15.5 of Bhagavad Gita. It's quite a long section that I'll read, but it's very interesting exactly how bhakti yoga works, why it is superior to any other form. That 23, halfway down the page, after the 15.5 quote, that param avyayam, or eternal kingdom, can be reached by one who is Nimana Moha. What does this mean? We are after designations. Someone wants to become Sir. Someone wants to become Lord. Someone wants to become the president, or a rich man, or a king, or something else. As long as we are attached to these designations, we are attached to the body, because designations belong to the body. But we are not these bodies, and realizing this is the first stage in spiritual realization. We are associated with the three modes of material nature, but we must become detached through devotional service to the Lord. If we are not attached to devotional service to the Lord, then we cannot become detached from the modes of material nature. Interesting point. Designations and attachments are due to our lust and desire, our wanting to lord it over the material nature. As long as we do not give up this propensity of lording it over the material nature, there is no possibility of returning to the kingdom of the Supreme and Sanatana Dham. That eternal kingdom, which is never destroyed, can be approached by one who is not bewildered by the attractions of false material enjoyments, who is situated in the service of the Supreme Lord. One so situated can easily approach that supreme abode. So here Prabhupada is making it very, very clear that the key to advancement and the key to being aloof from material entanglement and attraction is the identification, I am servant of Krishna. Any other designation, even if it appears to be a spiritual designation, will create problems. We may think, I'm a Brahmin. A Brahmin can become proud of being a Brahmin and create disturbance. The only safe designation, if we actually want to attain Godhead, is I am servant of the servant of the servant of Krishna. And this is what Prabhupada is explaining here. How simply by taking on this designation and attempting to live the designation, then we can become detached from the modes of material nature. That's a very powerful statement. We can become detached from the modes of material nature, like they won't work on us if we have this designation as the underlining pin of our existence. Okay, so let's have a look at the first verse of this chapter. Today we'll be looking at verses 1 to 7. You'll see on the board that I put this together with the theme 12a, which is devotional service. And then I put it together with the verses we'll be studying on Tuesday also. That's because today we'll be looking at devotional service in comparison to other processes. So that's one aspect of looking at the bhakti process. And then on Tuesday we'll be looking at different aspects of the devotional process within itself, different levels within it itself. So that's why I've put the theme there for both days. So if you can begin your reading for Tuesday by reading through this theme and then do your reading, you'll find it makes a lot more sense. Okay, so in verse 1, Arjuna's speaking and he has a question. Arjuna inquired, which are considered to be more perfect, those who are always properly engaged in your devotional service or those who worship the impersonal Brahman, the unmanifested? So why is Arjuna asking Krishna this question? He's asking him for three main reasons. The first is that he wants to clarify his own position. He's attached to the personal two-armed form of Krishna. He wants to know if that position is secure. Is this the right thing to do? Second thing, he wants Krishna to clearly state that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the supreme aspect of the Absolute Truth. Krishna has just shown his universal form, so people may be inclined to think, well, this is the Absolute Truth. So he wants Krishna, after showing that universal form, to very clearly say the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the Absolute Truth, not the universal form, not Brahman. And the third thing he wants to ensure is that everyone easily and clearly understands that bhakti is superior. No other process is superior to bhakti. This is the path. So let's have a look at Prabhupada's pulpit. Avadut, would you like to read it? You'll have to excuse my madness. We're jumping around in a bit, but I have marked it, so hopefully it'll be readable. If you come here and read it over the mic, it'll be good. And I'll get you to read it from my book so I understand my madness. If we start here, and then we read it to here, then we jump over and read this. See my point?
Krishna has now explained about his personal, the impersonal, and the universal, and has described all kinds of devotees and yogis. Generally, the transcendentalists can be divided into two classes. One is impersonalist and the other one is personalist. Now, Arjuna is trying to settle the question of which process is easier and which is the... Right, this is on the next page, if you look in the first paragraph. We jumped over. Just from the beginning. It starts at the end of the first line. You see it? Now, Arjuna is trying to settle the question of which process is easier and which of the classes is most perfect. In other words, he is clarifying his own position because he is attached to the personal form of Krishna. He is not attached to the impersonal Brahman. He wants to know whether his position is secure. The impersonal manifestation, either in this material world or in a spiritual world of the Supreme Lord, is a problem for meditation. Actually, one cannot perfectly conceive of the impersonal feature of the Absolute Truth. Therefore, Arjuna wants to say, what is the use of such a waste of time? Arjuna experienced in the 11th chapter that to be attached to the personal form of Krishna is best, because he could thus understand all other forms at the same time, and there was no disturbance to his love for Krishna. This important question asked of Krishna by Arjuna will clarify the distinction between the impersonal and personal conceptions of the Absolute Truth.
So Krishna doesn't hesitate to answer Arjuna's question. He has a very clear understanding of what he thinks about this. So immediately he makes a very strong statement. We read that in verse 2. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, those who fix their minds on my personal form and are always engaged in worshipping me with great and transcendental faith are considered by me to be most perfect. So we can understand that this is at least the platform of Nishtha. At least the platform of Nishtha. Because fix their minds, that means the mind, we're not working from the mental platform anymore. We're not talking about acceptance and rejection anymore. The mind is just fixed on Krishna and Krishna consciousness. Whatever Krishna wants, that's good. So it's quite a high platform that Krishna is speaking about here. So Srila Prabhupada's purport to this verse is very sweet. And so I'd like us to read the whole purport. In answer to Arjuna's question, Krishna clearly says that he who concentrates upon his personal form and who worships him with faith and devotion is to be considered most perfect in yoga. For one in such Krishna consciousness, there are no material activities, because everything is done for Krishna. A pure devotee is constantly engaged. Sometimes he chants, sometimes he hears or reads books about Krishna, or sometimes he cooks prasadam or goes to the marketplace to purchase something for Krishna. Or sometimes he washes the temple or the dishes. Whatever he does not let a single moment pass without devoting his activities to Krishna. Such action is in full samadhi. I don't know about you, but when I read this, I automatically get image of Prabhupada doing these things. And I realize the potency of someone preaching what they're doing, preaching what they're actually living in their lives. So it's very, very powerful. And all of these things, we can see Prabhupada doing it, you know, going to the market and getting a sabji and cooking in the three-tier burner and all that kind of thing. It's very, very sweet purport, where he's being very, very practical. He knows because he does it. So he can write very, very practically and simply about this high stage of devotional service. Arjuna is very, very happy to hear what Krishna says in verse 2. But being a kshatriya, he's very curious by nature. So he wants to know, what is the situation of these impersonalists anyway? What is their destination? What do they actually attain? This is the nature of Kshatriyas. They're very, very curious. They're Jignasu. So they're very, very curious by nature. They want to know things, understand things. Their intelligence is very dynamic and prevalent in their personality. So in verses 3 to 5, Krishna really puts impersonalism and the personalist, impersonalism and the impersonalist themselves into perspective. He clearly explains to Arjuna the inferiority of the impersonalist realization process. In these verses he says, "But those who fully worship the unmanifested, that which lies beyond the perception of the senses, the all-pervading, inconceivable, unchanging, fixed and immovable, the impersonal conception of the absolute truth, by controlling the various senses and being equally disposed to everyone, such persons engaged in the welfare of all at last achieve me." So we can see here that we get an idea of Krishna's culture. Krishna is a very cultured person. He's not rough in his activities or in his words, even when he kills the demons. So he's not saying, "Oh, these guys are off the wall, you know, they don't know what they're doing, it's a useless path." What we'd say, he doesn't say. He says it in such a way that, you know, yes, all these things they have to do, but even then they're not going to attain the goal very easily. After many, many births, they'll have some success. So he's very politely telling them that, you know, this is not the way to do it. I just found it very interesting that we get a glimpse into Krishna's high-class nature and culture here. Then in the fifth verse, he continues, "For those whose minds are attached to the unmanifested and personal feature of the Supreme, advancement is very troublesome. To make progress in that discipline is always difficult for those who are embodied." Because we have, as Prabhupada explains in his purport, we have the bodily form very much fixed in our mind as an important concept. You know, we see it every morning in the mirror when we put on the tilak. We live with it. You know, so to try and understand the absolute truth of the Supreme as being formless, it sort of just doesn't sit quite well with our experience. This is one of the reasons that it's so difficult. Also, the mind, by its very nature, it needs taste. If the mind is, this is why Ruchi is such a, you know, we're getting to the safer side of practicing bhakti when we come to Ruchi, because when we have taste, when the mind has taste, then there's no difficulty. Huh? It's satisfied. Like if we're hungry and we eat, we're satisfied. So in the same way, the mind, if there's some taste in devotional service, then the mind will be satisfied. It won't give disturbance. So it's an impetus for us to ride over these rough waves of anatta nivritti, get to nishta. And from nishta, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that once we get to nishta, the path is very, very quick. He explains that it's just like you put a trail of gunpowder, and then you light it, and shoop. So once we actually make it to nishta, everything goes very, very quickly, at least to Bhav. Then we have to have special mercy to get to prem. So interesting points that Krishna is making here in these verses. So in his purport, Prabhupada explains some of the main reasons that bhakti is superior to impersonalism. He explains it very, very clearly. One is that it's very difficult for one who is embodied to meditate on the formless, as we just mentioned. Two, it's very difficult and anxiety-ridden to constantly have to restrain the senses rather than engage them. You know, constantly restraining the senses is like holding your fist tight all the time, you know? Let's do that as an exercise. Just hold your fist tight. Now relax them on the chair. Open your hand and just relax it on your book or your chair. Which can you live with easiest? We can't hold a closed fist forever. We just can't do it. It's not natural position. It has its function. Sometimes we may use it, especially in Vrindavan. But, you know, but the most comfortable thing is to be relaxed, isn't it? To be in a natural position. So bhakti is like that. It's like we don't have to have our fists clenched all the time to survive. So the third point the Prabhupada makes is that the impersonalist process is troublesome and it's very difficult. And not only that, But once you've been involved seriously in impersonalism, it's very, very difficult to take up bhakti because the heart has become so hardened that, you know, it's difficult to relate to devotees, it's difficult to relate to the Lord as having form. Because of your impersonalist practices, you've attained some opulences in terms of city. You have an incredibly strong mind. You have some ability, perhaps, in mystic opulences. Maybe you can read other people's minds, all sorts of things. So, you know, that doesn't make it easy to follow Trinadapi Sanichana. You know, you think you're something special. You're not the ordinary person. So all of these problems are there. Not only is the path itself difficult, but even if you have a breakthrough by the mercy of meeting a pure devotee and you take to bhakti, it will be difficult. In the initial stages, I know this from personal experience because I was practicing Brahmavati before I came to ISKCON. In the initial stages, it looks like you're really advanced. You know, you've got your regulation together, you know, you don't eat much, you don't sleep much, you do everything right, you know. But then when you get over the externals and you start to look at the internals, it's very tough. There's a lot of obstacles there, and you know, just looking at the dirt that's in the cracks, it becomes tough then. You have to really put in a lot of hard work. So another point that Prabhupada makes is that the impersonalist process is dependent completely on your endeavor. Completely on your endeavor. Huh? That's pretty frightening, isn't it? What happens if we're sick? What happens if we grow old, which we all will? What's going to happen then? But the beauty of the bhakti process is that we're dependent mainly on Krishna. Of course we endeavor. But we know that even our endeavor, whether it's successful or not, depends on Krishna. Isn't it? Even in the simplest things we do, we can understand that we're dependent on Krishna. So it's such a strong, it must be so hellish to be thinking that whether I make it or break it depends on me. You know, it's such a difficult thing to live with, you know. Yeah. Very dry also, as Tapasrini is saying. So, you know, there's some very strong reasons why impersonalism is not the way to do it. And this purport, Prabhupada also explains the difference between nirgun and saugun worship. And he gives a very brilliant analogy, the analogy of the mailbox. We can see the little graphic here of mum lifting her little boy to put it the letter in the Radha Krishna mail. This system works. So have a look at what Prabhupada says here. It's a very clever way of explaining the potency of the deity and of deity worship. We'll start about 10 lines down, beginning of the purport to chapter 5. Here Prabhupada says, "The individual soul is embodied since time immemorial. It is very difficult for him to simply theoretically understand that he is not the body. Therefore, the bhakti yogi accepts the deity of Krishna as worshipable, because there is some bodily conception fixed in the mind which can thus be applied. Of course, worship of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his form within the temple is not idol worship. There is evidence in the Vedic literature that worship may be sagun or nirgun, of the Supreme possessing or not possessing attributes." So here sa means with and nir means without. So we're talking qualities. Gun means qualities in this instance. So Krishna with qualities or without qualities is what we're talking about. "Worship of the deity in the temple is sagun worship, for the Lord is represented by material qualities. Not that he's material, but he chooses to represent himself through material qualities. But the form of the Lord, though represented by material qualities such as stone, wood, or oil paint, is not actually material. That is the actual, that is the absolute nature of the Supreme Lord." A crude example may be given here. We may find some mailboxes on the street, and if we post our letters in those boxes, they will naturally go to their destination without difficulty. But any old box, or any imitation which we may find somewhere, but which is not authorized by the post office, will not do the work. It's such a brilliant analogy. God has an authorized representation in the deity form, which is called Archivigraha. This Archivigraha is an incarnation of the Supreme Lord. God will accept service through that form. The Lord is omnipotent, all-powerful. Therefore, by his incarnation as Archivigraha, he can accept the services of the devotee, just to make it convenient for the man in conditioned life. So kind of Krishna. And not only kind of Krishna, but as Yashoda was saying yesterday, but kind of Prabhupada, that we have such intimate and open access to the deity. I mean, where else can you just go and stand with the deity? You know? Such a wonderful atmosphere. Harinam in the background. You know, the deities are beautifully and cleanly taken care of. You know, so wonderful. So here Prabhupada is explaining that the deity form, potency, he's actually an incarnation. And he's empowered by Krishna to be as good as Krishna. As we make advancement, higher realms of bhakti, we'll see that there's no difference between the deity and Krishna. Krishna can speak to us in his deity form. He can do so many things, so many pastimes that we could tell about that. But because our heart is stone, we can relate to what we at this present time may see as a stone deity. But as the heart begins to purify and melt, then we realize who we're really looking at. In verses 6 and 7, Krishna directly deals with Arjuna's concern whether his attachment to Krishna's personal form is a secure position or not. Actually, Arjuna is expressing this concern on our behalf, because we're the ones with the doubts, isn't it? We're the ones with the thinking, well, maybe, you know, maybe this, maybe that, I'm not sure. So he's already said in Bhagavad Gita, his illusion's gone, his doubts are gone, he's ready to do what Krishna wants. He's sold out servant. So he's not asking these questions anymore for himself to clarify things. He's asking for our benefit. And Krishna's answer is very, very reassuring. It's a real confidence builder. In verses 6 and 7, he says, "But those who worship me, giving up all their activities unto me, and being devoted to me without deviation, engaged in devotional service, and always meditating upon me, having fixed their minds upon me, O son of Pritha, for them I am the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death." So here Prabhupada is giving us a real push. He's saying, okay, I'm just there, I'm waiting for you. All you have to do is endeavor to fix your mind on me. That's all you have to do. That's all I want you to do. Try and fix your mind on me, my service, my associates. This is all. This is all I'm expecting you to do. And then I'm there to do everything else. It's quite amazing. He's prepared to take care of everything else. Don't worry, I'll take care. You just fix your mind on me. So Srila Prabhupada, he picks up on Krishna's mood here and elaborates on it for our benefit in his purport. It's quite interesting what he says. It's on the second page of the purport, after the quote from Varaha Puran that I'd like to read. After that quote, it's about nine lines down. Prabhupada explains the essence of what Krishna is saying in these verses here. "Although a man who has fallen in the ocean may struggle very hard, and may be very expert in swimming, he cannot save himself. But if someone comes and picks him up from the water, then he is easily rescued. Similarly, the Lord picks up the devotee from this material existence. One simply has to practice the easy process of Krishna consciousness and fully engage himself in devotional service." It's amazing. All we have to do is apply ourselves to devotional service and Krishna will do the rest. We don't even have to think about it. We don't have to think about it. He'll do everything. I'd like to actually share a very different angle of vision on this from Bhagavatam. Prabhupada, it's in, where was it from? It's from the 10th canto, 10th canto, 2nd chapter, verse 28. Prabhupada takes out the first two lines of the second verse that we've just talked about, 6 and 7. Tesham aham samudata mrityu sansara sagarat. He takes these two verses and he gives a very, very amazing purport. It's so different than what he's giving here in Bhagavad Gita. It's a very advanced platform. We have to remember we're talking from chapter 10th canto. But I found it fascinating. He says there, those who are truly vipassacit learned are those who have reached the platform of understanding and observing the Supreme Personality of Godhead in any condition of life. They can see Krishna in any condition of life. Premanjana charita bhakti vilochanena shantasa davhridesha viloka yanti. Brahma Samhita 5.38. Learned devotees accept even conditions of distress as representing the presence of the Supreme Lord. When a devotee is in distress, he sees that the Lord has appeared as distress just to relieve or purify the devotee from the contamination of the material world. He actually sees the distress as Krishna come to save him from the contamination of the material world. This is very, there's so many difficulties in dealing with Vrindavan, living in Vrindavan. So many things come up in different ways. Huh? But if we see that all aspects of it are Krishna coming to relieve us of our attachment to the material world, then the whole concept and the whole idea changes, and we can deal with it a lot better. While one is within this material world, one is in various conditions, and therefore a devotee sees a condition of distress as but another feature of the Lord. And then he quotes, Tat te nukampam susab mikshanmanaha. He's quoting Srimad Bhagavatam 10.14.8. A devotee therefore regards distress as a great favor of the Lord because he understands that he's being cleansed of contamination. Then he quotes 12.7, Tesham aham samudatta mritya sansara sagarat. The appearance of distress is a negative process intended to give the devotee relief from the material world, which is called mritya sansara, or the constant repetition of birth and death. To save a surrendered soul from the repeated birth and death, the Lord purifies him of contamination by offering him a little distress. This cannot be understood by a non-devotee, but a devotee can see this because he is vipassacit, or learned. A non-devotee, therefore, is perturbed in distress, but a devotee welcomes distress as another feature of the Lord. Sarvam kalpidam brahma. A devotee can actually see that there is only the Supreme Personality of Godhead and no second entity. Ekam evad vityam. There is only the Lord who presents himself in his different energies. It's so powerful. So incredibly powerful. Reminds me of a song by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. I think it's Saranagati. It might be Gitavali, but I think it's Saranagati. Where he says that whether happiness or distress comes, I'm happy. And he explains why he's happy. He's happy because to leave the material realm and go back to Krishna, we have to be free of the reaction to piety and impiety. So when we're experiencing distress, apart from this distress that comes from offending or like that, but like distress that comes from pap, from simple activity, then what's happening is we're burning up that reaction to our previous impiety. And when we experience happiness, apart from the bliss of Krishna consciousness, but general feeling of well-being and like that, then we're experiencing release from the reaction of piety. Isn't that amazing? So both have to go. So the devotee who's actually set his mind, yesterday we were talking about we have to have the goal as being Krishna. The supreme goal is Krishna. So then whether happiness or distress comes, he's happy. Wow, I'm getting rid of it. Finally, I'm getting rid of it. You know, less on the plate. When the plate's completely clean, I can go back. This is wonderful. Of course, it's easier to say than to do. But if we keep this in mind and we practice it, when the distress comes, think, this is Krishna relieving me of my attachment to the material world. This is Krishna relieving me of my reaction to sinful activity of the past. Thank you, Krishna. Instead of, why are you doing this to me? You know, I'm doing everything properly. Why are you doing this to me? Not like that. Thank you, Krishna. Just a different perspective will mean for very rapid advancement. At this point, I'd like to ask if anyone is brave enough to share a period of distress and devotional service that actually they could later see was purification or did lead to necessary realizations to continue on in devotional service. Can anyone think of such a time? I'm brave enough to share it.
All of you, having noticed that I haven't been present in this class for 3 days, may have wondered or had an idea of what was the cause, and the cause being that my so many things. Being first of all in a position where I refuse to attempt to obey my teacher's orders because of some lack of security in my own capacity, because of lack of surrender and faith in Krishna that he will help me achieve that challenge, because of childishness, I guess, because of lack of submission and surrender to authority as such, I guess, and because of some, let's say, previous references that were not sorted out in my relationship with Srimati Mataji and which are now sorted out by Krishna's great mercy. So therefore I underwent a very troublesome time getting different devotees involved in my plea for understanding and different things, and it became quite an ordeal, but finally by devotees' mercy, especially some of them, I got to meet with Srimati Mataji and have a good explanation on both sides and have reassessment of my position, of my understanding of myself. I realized that I was actually a very crippled person. Well, I realized that before that, but I realized that there is a way to get out of it. And so she's willing to help me, so I'm very, very grateful. And I'm very also, I feel very shameful that I have actually misunderstood her reaction towards me. And so I feel very shameful about that, which is a pain in itself, because shame is, you know, especially, you know, that kind of shame, you know, too. And now I'm getting pain here and cold here as reaction of everything, of general weakness, but I'm very happy because everything is sorted out and I'm back amongst you, and thank you very much, and please forgive me. Hare Krishna.
This is the amazing thing about love between devotees in the material realm. What they call love is very much based on externals and things being successful. But in devotee exchanges and relationships, quite often the periods of difficulty are the periods of time when the relationship becomes strongest and goes deepest, because we have a different understanding of what we're dealing with. And we understand that the personality that we're dealing with right now is not the real one. We have to go a bit deeper and clean up our acts so that we can become reestablished in our original personality and form and be able to engage in eternal loving relationships. There will, of course, because we're aspiring for Golok, there will, of course, be confusions there also, misunderstandings. But they will have a sweetness there that we got a taste of with this situation. Many, many times we see misunderstandings, not only between Radha and Krishna, but between Radha and her servants, like that. So, our perspective, how we see things as devotees, if we see them in light of the goal, the reality, then life becomes an adventure. Life becomes so amazing, And it takes you out of the material realm, actually, when you see everything here in relation to there. While your reference is only here, it's such a hellish existence, you know? But, you know, like Tapaswini was talking this morning, she's just so fried with these lusty men in Vrindavan. There's a lot of them, you know? I mean, there's so many cheap men in this place. But if you see them as Dvidita Gorilla, you know, remember Dvidita Gorilla pastime, or, you know, then you can laugh at it. You know, just put them in their place. To see it in terms of Krishna Leela. Then it's not a problem anymore. Well, you know, at least it's less of a problem. But, yeah. Anybody else like to share an experience they've had? Yeah. Yeah, please come here.
I hope this is relevant. Yeah. But about... I was here about 7 years ago, and I knew this one Mariji from Australia, and she was like a hypochondriac. I thought she was anyway. She was always sick. And I'd always see her going past, like, the window or something, hunched over, crawling. I was like, God, you know, it's so depressing. Do I have to look at someone like that, right? I was really puffed up. And anyway, I remember discussing, like, I was around the table, and I'd just gotten back from doing Govardhan Parikram, but I'd eaten so much. I'd eaten 4 pieces of Balaram cake, I'd eaten 3 samosas, and it was so hot, right? So I was starting to feel a little giddy in my stomach, but I was at the restaurant. That's when it was actually functioning nicely. And I was at the restaurant eating with all the devotees, and they were saying, poor Krishna Leela, it's like she's going to pass away, what are we going to do? And I said, oh, just get it. I was making jokes. I said, just get it to sign on the dotted line.
What?
All her possessions over to us. Just get it to sign on the dotted line. I was just making a whole joke about it, like, you know, the poor girl was so sick. I said, she's always complaining about some sickness. She's just a hypochondriac. The next day, I couldn't move. It was like a magnet to my bed. I passed Julie in my bed. I couldn't actually move. And as I was laying there, I lived near her. I would see her walking past, hunched over. Walking past me. And it was a while later that I realized why I'd got that reaction. It was because I was so offensive to this poor devotee. I was so uncompassionate. And then we'd both be doing it together. We'd pass each other in the hall, you know. I'd be crawling like her in the hallway to the toilet.
So I had one horrific experience after another my first couple of years as a devotee. And while I was in Nairobi, it was a very small temple, just a few devotees, just a few men, a couple of women. I think there were maybe 5 men and 3 women. And I was the driver. I used to bring in the donations of vegetables and so on. It was hard to get cash, so I used to bring donations of kind to the temple, and practically everything that went out of the temple and went into the temple went through my hands, which included the banking and so forth. So the boys wanted the boys had to share the cars. I had the Datsun pickup, and they had a car. So they all had to share the car, and I had the pickup most of the day. So one night... And, you know, they would say something to me, and I would just talk, you know, I would say, well, listen, I got this schedule, and I got to do this. And I was never one to back down or suffer silently or anything either. I would just say straight off what was on my mind. So one night I was in the kitchen, because I was also the cook. I was making the Lord's 9 o'clock boiled down milk and finishing off the daily sweets for the next day. I had to make a couple days in a row because, I mean, that was my schedule. It was just too tight. So I was in there doing my thing on a 6-burner stove. I don't know if you ever saw one of those. And 4 or 5 boys walked in, brahmacharis walked into the kitchen. And I just looked at them all across from the stove, and they said a whole bunch of things, which they concluded was, we're just tired of hearing your lip. We don't want to hear your back talk. We don't want to hear, you know. And one of them actually said, and Prabhupada said, you could beat a mridanga and you could beat a woman. So I heard myself say across from this stove to all of them, this was almost an out-of-body experience. I said, according to whose authority? That woman has to be your wife. And then one of them said, oh, Bhagawan's authority. And then they, it's like they said whatever they had to say, and then they said, well, if we hear one more thing out of your mouth, we're coming back with a stick. So then they turned around and they all left. They weren't brave enough to approach me one at a time. They all had to come together. So I was at least 10 pounds lighter than I am now. And of course, I was only 25 or 26. So this is a threatening age to most young men. So they went out, and then I was a little bit in shock, so I locked the kitchen door and finished my sweets, you know, rolling the balls, and, you know, and then I slipped out the back and unlocked the door so the pujari could pick up whatever it was. And then I went to my room, which I shared with a few other Matajis, and grabbed my chutter, my bead bag, and went out into the night. Now, I don't know if you know what Nairobi is like, but it's very scary because, first of all, there's no street lights on that street, and it's right in a dacoit neighborhood full of hoodlums, and people regularly get their ears cut off so that the guys can grab their earrings and fingers also. So I don't know whether I should just let myself at the mercy of the brahmanas or go out into the night and let myself at the mercy of the dacoits, but I thought, well, Krishna protect me. So I went out into the road, flagged on the first pair of headlights that I saw in a car, and Krishna protected me. It was the big, fat Sadarji, one Sikh guy, with some huge women and a whole bunch of kids in the car, and asked me where I wanted to go. So I said, nothing came out of my mouth. I just, I want to go to my family doctor. It was 9:30 at night. So, and no intelligent person would be on the streets at that time. So they drove me to one of my friends who happened to be a doctor. And I stayed overnight there. I kind of like, as soon as I came to the door, for all my bravado or whatever I do, I actually broke down right then and there. I've very rarely cried in my life, but this was like I just completely fell apart, realizing that I couldn't be in control. And I didn't know what to do, but I was taking shelter of some devotees. So they helped me find Brahmananda the next day. He was out of town for a day. And Brahmananda drove me back to the temple and had a lecture, a stiff lecture, to all these boys about the dangers of discouraging devotees from their devotional service. And demanded that they apologize. Well, some of them actually came to the door and gave some kind of left-handed apology with a butt clause. One of them actually came and apologized very sincerely. And it looks like it changed the whole course of his life, basically speaking. And I was able to help him later on, actually, collect something for the deity so that he could bring stuff back after the Mayapur festival. But he actually was the only devotee who talked to me for more than 30 seconds and poured out his heart. And he said, actually, you know, when you think about devotee relations, it's a very important thing, and to discourage somebody from devotional service. But because his heart had changed and he saw what he'd been doing and he saw that he'd been influenced by these other guys, that I see him from time to time whenever he comes to India. He's very bright-faced and very happy. And the others I see, they're very glum. They're known for their brutality and their nastiness, even now. But this devotee, very became very, let's say, internalized. For myself, I realized, I suppose, if I can give it out, I suppose I have to take it also. But I also noticed that this, among other things, prepared me for a lot of other really heavy tests that I would have to take later on in devotional life. It's some of it heavier and heavier. But whatever it is, it prepared me for all those other experiences and helped me to see that actually Krishna has a hand. He takes a personal hand in whatever distress he gives you. Hare Krishna.
The longer I'm in this class, the more amazed I am at you guys. Not only in terms of talents, but in terms of experience and experiences. It's quite amazing. Okay, any questions on today's class? Or the purports that you've read through last night? So if you put that in together with the title of the chapter, you can understand what we're supposed to do if we're devotees. Yeah, this is the essence. The externals will follow if the consciousness is fixed. So if we put our effort into remembering Krishna, and remember what Prabhupada said in the 8th chapter, remembering Krishna means Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. So even, you know, we're picking flowers, we're cooking, whatever we're doing, we can be chanting. If not externally, we can chant internally. And the more we make that a habit, and it's easy to make that habit, the more you hear Prabhupada chanting, the more you can make it your own habit. If you have, you know, Prabhupada japa tape, or kirtan tape, his vibration is so pure, you become attracted to, you know, sometimes, not here because I don't have a good machine here, tape recorder here, but in Mayapur I have Prabhupada japa going practically all the time. And it gets to a point that even when it's not on, I can hear it. It's incredible. It just becomes a state of consciousness, Prabhupada's chanting. It's very powerful. Any other questions? Yeah. Well, this is another reason why focus of mind is so important. I mean, we have Bhagavatam, but how many can enter into Bhagavatam? Through these slokas, we can enter into the pastime. Sages do that. How often do we even make, like, conscious contact with Bhagavatam? Let alone enter into the slokas. You can enter into Prahlada Leela through the 7th canto. Have a look around, see what's happening. You can do that. But there has to be that purity, that potency that comes from purity. Like that. And the purity we're talking, no dirt. So when there's no dirt, then the mind can be very, very fine line fixed. Almost like a laser edge. More powerful than a laser. It's transcendental. And then amazing things can be revealed. You get a little bit of a taste of it in Kartik, because Radharani is so merciful. It sort of like cuts through the material realm. Sometimes you just get that, you know, like taste of the transcendence of Gokul Dham. But if we can actually become fixed in our mind on Krishna, then we'll have that experience all the time. And our reality will be a whole different reality. Our reality will start when we open Bhagavad Gita, when we open Bhagavatam, when we open CC. You know? Not that we just read about the pastimes, we can enter into them. As Shastra is, you know, it's one of the purposes of Shastra. So we can enter into that. I mean, that's a very high standard, very high platform. But we should remember these things. You know, be aware of the full gamut rather than little box. You know? Little boxes aren't very interesting. I have to be very careful what you pray. Yeah. Yeah. It's a practical process. It works.
And then I realized again, because now I'm pushing on. And then I realized also when you were giving us
those. What else do we have hands for? Take the show, make garlands. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, becoming serious is, beginning of madhyam. It's the beginning of madhyam. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a fact. This gets back to what we were talking earlier about turning the critical mentality towards ourselves and seeing, you know, what's there for us to deal with inside. You know, because we can tell basically whether we're entering into the field of madhyam, or whether we're starting to pick up on the quality of our service and the different things that we do. You know, we're starting to analyze and to really look deeply at how we do things, how we think about things. Then we can understand that we're finally getting serious about devotional service. We're coming to the threshold of madhyam. Because, you know, in the beginning stages, we're just, you know, we think we're God. If we're not God, we're at least the best devotee, you know. And we're not humble. It's so easy. We're getting so much mercy when we first come. You know, how come these guys are struggling? This is far up, so easy. You know, and then, you know, that wears off after a while because of our offenses, and we realize where we're really at. And then we have to make a choice. Are we going to struggle and come up, or are we going to just struggle? Or not struggle and stay down? So, but when we start to look very seriously at how we're doing things, like the quality of how we're doing things, do we pick flowers and break branches? You know? And do we, you know, like pay our obeisances and make it impossible for anybody else to move around? You know? Sometimes at Mangalarati it's impossible to move because you've got a, you know, three or four brahmacharis lined up like a wall and there's just nowhere to move, you know? Or they come in and they, you know, push you out of the way so they can pay their obeisances. So, this, you know, like, okay, we accept it, it's not a problem, but for ourselves we see, do we do that kind of thing? Do we slam doors? You know, how do we relate to things? So, when we start to get serious, that means we start to use a critical facility we have. It's part of the intelligence. We have that critical facility, so we apply it to ourselves. And we start getting very, very serious. We're so busy weeding out all the anattas in our own heart, we don't have time to look at anybody else. There's such a mess here. You know, oh, God, another one. Oh. You know, keeps us busy. We don't have time for anything else. And then we don't commit offences. We're so busy with the garden. It has full-time service in itself, that garden. What with the watering and the weeding and, you know, making sure that monkeys don't get in to destroy the whole thing, or elephants, even elephants come into the garden. Have to be very careful, yeah. Yeah, because they've surrendered their life to Krishna. Okay, so we have a couple of questions here. Does anyone, we're running a bit short of time. Does anybody have trouble with these questions? We need to go through them in class. These three questions above here, anyone have trouble with those? They read, why is personless realization process superior to the impersonless one? Give five reasons. And then two, please explain sagun and nigun worship and use a Mayavada's analogy to explain the potency of the deity and deity worship. Pardon? Yeah. They're in Papa's purport. Actually, if you look at your fill-in sheet, we'll be filling that in next week. That will give you the answers. Okay, so Tapaswini, would you like to come and say something?
I apologize because I'm not very prepared today. I just quickly tried to prepare something. So for my own person, sorry, am I in the way? Okay. For my personal understanding and what I got from these seven verses, I'd like to start with the key verse, which was verse 5, which is a key verse for defeating impersonalism. I'll just read from the purport. Because we've been conditioned for so long, it's really difficult for one to simply theoretically understand we are not this body. As devotees, we therefore accept the deity of Krishna as worshipable, because there is some bodily conception fixed in the mind which can thus be applied. So for me, I could understand that I see him on that only on the theoretical level. but not from my heart. So you mentioned also that in the class that one has to, the different levels of nishta, and then from anatta nivritti, then you get to nishta, but you have to have a taste, even coming along with anatta nivritti. So I realized that that's what I'm lacking, was the taste. I was baffled. I was thinking, I wrote this down, it didn't make sense. Then I understood what you said is actually I'm not getting a taste, and that's why it's not that I'm trying to get to the nishta stage so much, but I'm not having a taste while I'm going through taking out my anattas. So I think that's something that I have to work on and find out how I can. So I need to go deeper and understand, not just hover on the mental platform because it's too dry for me. Okay, so that was from verse 5. And then from purport to 6 and 7, there was no need to consider the sinful activities of his past life because the Lord fully takes charge of him. So from this I was thinking how actually how fortunate we really are that we sometimes are so proud of our past lives, isn't it? We think, oh, I must have been this and I must have been some yogi, isn't it? Or some to come to Krishna consciousness. But then when you look at, say, you know, a dog mating with another dog on the street, for me that's more real, actually, for how many bodies we've actually been through and abominable activities we've had, sinful activities, not just how pious we were in the past, isn't it? And Krishna's actually going to take all that away. I was thinking, just reflecting on that and how fortunate actually I was. Another point, I should look here, sorry. From verse 1, Srila Prabhupada states that actually one cannot perfectly conceive the impersonal feature of the Absolute. Therefore, he states, Arjuna wants to say, what is the use of such a waste of time? So then I reflected, actually, how am I really utilizing my time? And how am I trying to smash any impersonal tendency that I have? For example, Parvati was saying how when you greet a devotee that you're happy to see them. I know for myself sometimes I will see a devotee and I will do my best to ignore them. Like, really, doing really well to ignore them. And then they see me and then I say, oh, I'm so surprised. Hello, how are you? And then I walk off thinking, I've got to do better next time. You know, it's such an impersonal type of mentality. Like, I don't want to get in that situation again where I have to deal with that person. And just not that, even how we interact with each other. For example, even we ask questions of each other. We don't relate to each other as a devotee or a spirit soul. We may relate to each other as, so, what star sign are you? Isn't it? We want to know about your conditioning, but we actually not really caring about how you are as a devotee or how you are as related to Krishna. So that was my realizations on the personal level. Then preaching kind of went downhill. Preaching from, okay, so verse 1. This verse will clarify the distinction between impersonalism and personal concepts of the Absolute Truth. And also from verse 1 and 7, there were four key verses used to defeat impersonalism. I'm sure everyone picked that up from the exam. So also verse 5, Prabhupada points that if one wants to follow impersonally, it's actually really difficult. So one has to understand the unmanifested supreme through the Upanishads, or have to learn the language, understand non-perceptual feelings. Also in verse 3, it's also mentioned that one has to control senses, render service to everyone, and engage in the welfare of all beings. So stated here that one having to go to such an endeavor and then the ultimate result is uncertain. So then, as Arjuna wanted to say, what is this use of such a waste of time? So actually, it's just all a waste of time. Also, what's present in verse 6 to 7, the different yoga processes can transfer the soul to whatever planet. Prabhupada states that the devotee does not wait to become very experienced in order to transfer himself to the spiritual sky. The Lord states in the verse, he will become the deliverer. So we just have to rely on that. That the Lord will become the deliverer. He will deliver him. Deliver. Sorry.
Then that was the preaching, and then I have the Muda mission is that bhakti is superior to impersonalism, basically. That's what was stated. And from verse 6 to 7, Srila Prabhupada expresses that though a devotee goes through so many difficulties, he can overcome because he has faith that Krishna will personally take care and deliver him. Therefore, the devotee's responsibility is to cultivate devotion and eagerness to serve the Lord. That intense pure desire to serve Krishna attracts his full mercy. So there's no need for one to consider the sinful actions of his past life because the Lord fully takes charge of him. There was also two analogies. A child is completely cared by his parents, and thus his position is secure. That's what that also Arjuna was stating, asking that question. And another analogy is a man has fallen into the ocean. He may be an expert swimmer, but he cannot be saved. Only if someone comes along and picks him up from the water, then he is rescued. So Srila Prabhupada makes the point that one shouldn't try to deliver himself in spiritual realization by his own endeavor, and just take shelter of Krishna. And then verse 5, by the grace of some devotee, such a transcendentalist, highly learned in the process of Gyan, may come to the point of devotional service. So Prabhupada says that again.
Okay, now I want to do a little exercise on what we've spoken about today. We'll do it as a whole group. Has everybody taken down what's on the board, or does it need to stay? You want me to leave it on? Yeah, I can do that. No problem. Okay. So we'll do it verbally. Can anyone describe Brahman? Just tell me anything you know about Brahman. Right? Brahman is the personal effulgence of the Lord. Just brainstorm. Pardon? Formless, yes. All-pervading, yeah, good. No variety, good. Anything else? Now describe Radha Shyam Chandra. Sweet. Shorts. Sweet shorts. Anything else? Pure love, merciful. He's cheeky, that's true, especially when he's in his shorts. Full of pastimes? What else? Smiling. Pardon? Smiling. He's smiling. He loves Radha. What else? Very curly hair. He fascinates everybody. Is it easier to describe Brahman or Radhasham? Radhasham. Okay. Now, next question is, please tell me how you could develop your relationship with Brahman.
I can't hear you.
Please tell me how you could develop your relationship with Brahman. Uh-huh. Okay. Any other way? By seeing Brahman everywhere, in every object. What's another way we could develop our... Is that a relationship with Brahman, or is that just an acknowledgement of Brahman's presence? How can we develop our relationship with Brahman? We cannot. How can we develop our relationship with Radha Shyam? We can offer him garlands and fruits. Voice of practical experience. Voice of practical experience. Anything else? How else can we develop our relationship with Radha Shyam? Pardon? We can pray to them, yes. What else? Talk to them. We can carry them on Brajman Parikram. What else can we do to develop our relationship with them? Sing to them. So many different ways, isn't it? So it's so much more natural to, it's so much easier to describe the form of the Lord rather than the formless aspect. To develop the relationship, yeah, smell also. It's incredible. So I want you just to close your eyes and take darshan of Radha Shyam today. Can you remember what set they're wearing? How Radharani's hair is decorated? What she's holding in her hands? Just take
close to darshan. You can go to Gonitai, I don't mind. Now, just think, there's the fourth altar, and there we have Brahman giving darshan. Please take darshan of Brahman. That's so interesting, is it? It's like being in a closet with light bulbs on all around. That's true. Okay, any other questions or comments? We have 5 minutes, so I just want you to get in pairs of your choice and take, well, I wanted to do a full workshop, we won't have time today. Take one of the aspects of Krishna's 5-point success formula from 1155 and with your partner just talk about how you can improve that aspect. Choose one that you're both interested in and talk about how you can improve it. So the five are Mad Bhakta, our service must be performed purely, that is, there should be no other engagement. Sangha Bhajata, free from karma and jnana and the association of karmis and jnanis. 3. Mad Kamakrit, must be performed, our work must be performed in relationship with Krishna for his pleasure. 4. Mad Paramaha, Krishna must be the supreme goal of our lives. And 5, Nirvairaha, must be friendly to everyone. That means sharing Krishna and Krishna consciousness with everybody. So just got a couple of minutes. Quickly get into pairs. Choose one that both of you are interested in and just brainstorm on ways that you can actually improve that aspect in your own life.